Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. How do we cope when confronted with major challenges? Consider the events of September 11th, 2001. Our guest cultural observer, Susan Faludi, demonstrates that tragedies did not end on that sad day when America experienced firsthand the painful fact that vulnerability is part of being human. She says our media and government blanketed us with the worn-out notion that somehow we should be exempt from suffering instead of leading us in learning from the experiences. Ms. Faludi spells out this false John Wayne fantasy of invulnerability in her powerful book, The Terror Dream. In addition to finding the roots of our fear and fantasy in post-9/11 America, Ms. Faludi offers hopeful antidotes. She is in good company, proposing it is time to reject the adolescent yearnings our government and media sold us and begin to face facts as grown-ups.
As Christian Breitwiser, one of the Jersey girls, said in her book several years after this, and she ended it on a very mournful, melancholy note. She said, you know, I feel like Americans just refuse to confront the truth. And that's where we must start. We have to begin to deal with the real world, even when we don't like that, and even when it does not fit our mythic notions of how we should be as a people.
Susan Faludi is an acute observer of American culture, and she is a journalist. While working for the Wall Street Journal, she won the Pulitzer Prize for her reporting on the high costs of high finance. In addition to her book, The Terror Dream, her two prior books were bestsellers. They were Backlash, The Undeclared War Against American Women, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award, and Stiffed, The Betrayal of the American Man. Ms. Faludi also writes for The New Yorker and The Nation magazines, The New York Times, and The Los Angeles Times. Before discovering Susan Faludi, Bill Russell and I felt we had a visceral understanding of what America had lost on 9/11. After reading The Terror Dream, we were certain we'd leave this conversation with Susan Faludi knowing a great deal more than when we three sat down together. Susan Faludi, I pay a lot of attention to my dream life. I figure I spend a third to a half of my time there. I should pay attention. So when The Terror Dream came through, I thought, well, that might be a nice place to visit or not, but I wouldn't want to live there. It seems to me that you're suggesting that we think about The Terror Dream, but tell me where this title comes from, because The Terror Dream is not necessarily fun.
No. It probably should be called The Terror Nightmare, but yeah. I called it The Terror Dream because I named it after a story that was actually the basis for the classic John Ford Western, The Searchers, the novel on which the movie was based. Has as its protagonist this young man who is haunted by what he calls the terror dream. And it's this humiliating memory that he keeps trying to suppress of his himself as a boy hiding in the brush while his whole family is killed by Indians. And I chose that title because it seemed that after 9/11, we were just thrown into and haunted by this national version of the terror dream where we were face to face with our own vulnerability and our own shame. And rather than really grapple with it honestly, we retreated into myth and fantasy.
I want to go to shame in just a minute, but it seems to me it's also very important that you draw on what is the heart of the American culture, which is our entertainment obsession, and
right.
The fact that you're speaking to a movie that a lot of people know, and there are lots of spin-offs all the way down to Spielberg, et cetera,
right.
Between the original and John Ford, and your book that bounces off of it. That the fact that you're in the entertainment arena,
right.
Is important too, isn't it?
Entertainment and media, and there's a fine
and
line.
What's the difference these days?
I have no idea. I don't think there is one anymore.
Yeah.
But, and The Searchers, you know, regardless of whether one has seen The Searchers or not, you've been influenced by it because it's such a seminal movie. It influenced a whole generation of movie makers. Spielberg, who you mentioned, who watched it a million times and actually shot a version of The Searchers when he was a little boy in his suburban backyard, projected it on a he had a sheet in which he painted Monument Valley. But after 9/11, Spielberg did this movie, a version of War of the Worlds, and what struck me, it's very, I mean, it has all kinds of references to 9/11. There's the missing posters that's set roughly in, you know, in the New York, New Jersey area in the beginning.
Those are posters that are saying somebody's missing. Not a poster that's absent.
Right. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Not a wanted, dead or alive poster. That's another chapter in the book. In the story, Tom Cruise plays this kind of deadbeat divorced dad who, in the midst of his intergalactic attack, he is intent on rescuing his daughter from Martians and from a molester. And then he finally brings her back. Never mind that the world's ending. All is well because he carries her sort of Pieta style back to mom, which is precisely the final... final scene in The Searchers.
We're with Susan Faludi. We will all be back in a moment when I will hand it back over to Bill Russell. I'm Paula Gordon, Susan Faludi. Bill, we all hope that you're with us when we return in just a moment. We're back. I'm Paula Gordon, Bill Russell, Susan Faludi. We're talking about the big ideas that you have in The Terror Dream, and I promised Bill Russell, so I'll be a good person and give it back to you.
You answered a question or provided a representation that I've been unconsciously looking for the last 6 years. I have been thinking deranged. I have been thinking maddening, madness, lunacy. Actually, I hadn't been thinking deranged because that was the word you chose to describe the media reaction and the public reaction. Partly, I think, you know, as the public because of the myths you talk about, but also because they were well led and well instructed in that derangement.
Or poorly led and well instructed.
Well, yes. but the derangement seems to me to be central. All the other. I mean, there's a great deal in what you're talking about, but the derangement, the cultural, the social derangement that was consequent, starting within 5 minutes of the event.
Right. The event being the attacks of 9/11 in 2001 in America.
Right. Continues. I mean, there have been a few people who have tried to punch through that. Most of them. And we'll talk about the reviews of your book. have been savaged for their efforts, but I found that to me was an appropriate word. And since you found it, and I hadn't,
deranged.
How did you get there?
Well, you know, I wrote this book because I wanted to try and understand what happened to us as a culture after 9/11. Because if you go back and you look, and as you say, right from the get-go, you notice something very strange. It's not. Much of our reaction was not as if we were reacting to the actual threat. We seemed to fall into this odd fever dream where our politicians and our pundits were reenacting some Wild West drama, spouting all this vigilante rhetoric about smoke them out of their holes and shoot them between the eyes. The latter was a quote from a New York Post commentator. And all this talk about how the war on terror was going to be a return to our days of taming the frontier and fighting the Indians, and a lot of chatter about how we were scared housewife security moms wanted protection, and how men would be protecting the family from savage attacks in the home by terrorists. So it was all very peculiar because here we have hijackers aiming the planes at the symbols of commercial and military power, yet we seem to be reacting as a culture as if they were aimed at our home and hearth.
What happened to the adults? in this drama. I'm sure it's as if the adults forgot to show up through this entire event, and it continues to be the case.
Right, it's real cowboy and Indian, and it's
childish. It's puerile. It's remarkable.
Well, in some ways, it's adolescent.
But I'm serious about that. There have to be some, out of 300 plus or minus million Americans, plus a few other differently interested foreigners. Mm-hmm. There are adults. There are people who could see what was going on, and yet we never saw them or heard from them.
Right. Well, they weren't at the helm. But beyond that, the mythology that we reached for, this sort of consoling fiction of the protective John Wayne figure and the imperiled maiden is our central mythology, and it is essentially an adolescent mythology. It's the lone man who's basically an adolescent who's not in the drama we tell ourselves that came out of the Victorian era that we've been working on for all these years is a story about sort of a Natty Bumppo Hawkeye character from The Last of the Mohicans who does not have a relationship with a woman who it's the old Leslie Fiedler story of Huck Finn or of a perpetual boy who rescues women but then doesn't ever really have a long-term relationship with them.
You quote, obviously you've read Richard Slotkin's work and Dead Good and Tale. Richard is somewhere between a friend and a close acquaintance.
But he is magisterial, as you point out.
Yes, I actually had him read with much fear and trembling, since I usually admire him.
Yeah.
Had him review the manuscript.
And I suspect he was probably very pleased with it.
He said so in public.
He said to us that, he says in his work, and he said specifically to us that the American myth, in his view, came to an absolute terminal halt with the Vietnam War. We wore it out. Now, that now, I think, is sort of contradicted by what you're saying. But he goes on to say that any candidate myth for a new American myth, and myth in this context is not, we're not talking about fairy tales. We're talking about the underlying worldview that the community inhabits, the space, the world as we see it. It's that any myth has to deal with racism, American myth, the profound effects of racism in this country, and violence. Mm-hmm. Who gets to use it against whom?
Right.
And what you're dealing with, writing about, of course, is the latter piece of that. And it seems, based on that analysis and your analysis, we don't have a new myth. We're still sort of floundering around with the old one.
I mean, the old myth isn't working for us, if it ever did, which I would argue it was always pretty broken.
It's gotten us into some pretty bad places.
Right. And this time was no exception.
I would add that perhaps thinking along with you, I would enrich what Dr. Slotkin said by saying, yes, color, racism, yes, violence, and Susan Faludi, gender, about which we'll speak more when we return in just a moment. We're back with Susan Faludi here on The Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell was just talking about Richard Slotkin's magisterial work, Regeneration Through Violence, he calls it. Before we go too far
he also say in that concept we're talking about Richard, and you should give him credit, he also has written a 3-volume series, from which I think he took a lot of that, on the American myth, on the stories that are America. He's read all that stuff that most of us, I think, the Natty Bumppo series and all that early American fiction that is, to me, is extraordinary. But he's gone through this, the movies, the full culture that has gotten to this point. This is not just a matter of having an opinion.
Indeed. And it takes us back exactly to where I wanted to go when you say we've been working on this since the Victorian era. Mm-hmm. What Dr. Slotkin made,
or even
clear,
earlier,
exactly,
really the 18th century, it sort of came to fruition in the Victorian era.
The original story that comes out of the Puritan experience and out of the most lethal of our wars, which was against the Indians, more or less day one, with the Indians, I won't be able to pronounce the Indian's name so as to give it the right revolt name, but it's King William.
King
Philip, who precedes King William's wars. This is when
Metacom is his actual name.
It's when the Puritans who have just gotten there mm-hmm. are fighting with the Indians, and mm-hmm. it's ugly. And mm-hmm. you say that we go way back to that, but the Puritans had a different answer.
Right. Well, to back up, after 9/11, one of the many anomalies that were in evidence was perhaps the most profound one was this, that we kept hearing over and over again, attacks like these have never happened to America before. America's not a place that's vulnerable to assault on home soil. And certainly in recent times, that's the case. But if we go back and look at our earliest history, we see something very important. For the first two centuries, settlers, prevailing reality was being attacked on quote-unquote home soil. Now, needless to say, this was home soil that the settlers took from the Indians.
The Native Americans have a slightly different perspective
right,
on that.
Yes.
There was attack, there was war, but it was different.
Right. But from the point of view of the you know, the white mythology, the Native American story drops out. So when we look at how where the mythology came from, it was for 200 years, the story that the mythology conceals is a story of you know, repeated attacks by people that the settlers demonized as non-Christian, non-white, quote unquote terrorists.
That's explicit. I mean, you have Cotton
right.
Mather talking,
actually using that term,
and he's talking about the pirates 300 years ago. So this idea of
later on, he's talking about this, right? The Barbary Coast, and it's sort of this idea of captivity is this prevailing drama in that period, because over and over again, militias, leaders, husbands were not able to protect families in the frontier towns. On the story of the late 17th century to early 18th century is a story of family members being taken captive and not coming home. In that period, more than a quarter of women in New England towns who were taken captive were never rescued, and 60% of girls were never rescued.
Before we go past that opportunity, never rescued, and many of them wouldn't. Come
right.
back, about, chose not
exactly
to come
about
back.
A third of female captives they estimate in that period refused to return,
which is a direct affront to the masculinity that is being
well, the very traditional Puritan patriarchal
well,
system,
and,
which
and,
was hardly a feminist culture.
But it was also to the ethnocentricity of it. This is it goes to the it's not just violence, it's not just gender, it is
it's also race.
It's also
you
race,
bet.
Right?
You bet.
But and then on top of that, women in the genre of the era, which was the captivity narrative, there were example after example of women who defended themselves or negotiated their own rescue, like Mary Rowlandson,
who had the first bestseller in America.
That's right. And in fact, all of the, as Richard Slotkin points out, in the first century and a half, all but Pilgrim's Progress, all of the others that were bestsellers were captivity narratives. So you see in this early period, women, sort of a resourceful, stalwart womanhood that's held up as an example for both men and women to follow. And it's a more, even more complicated story than that, because there is actually a endorsement of dependency, if it's dependency on God, and that the whole idea of being attacked and in the Puritan mindset suggested that they had gone away from dependency on God and needed to re-embrace that, which was another reason why where gender enters, with women as an example, an embodiment of that.
I loved seeing that because it reminded me that to be vulnerable can be a learning opportunity.
Right.
And what I remember most about 9/11 after seeing it, and of course all of us were shocked to see people dying in front of our eyes, mm-hmm. Bill made me turn the television off because he said, we're not going to know anything. for weeks.
Right.
So don't do this to yourself.
Right. Turned out I was wrong. It was years. It was
years,
still
exactly. Right. But the question that I asked myself was, at that night, and I wrote it down, my question to myself is, what are we going to learn from this?
Mm-hmm.
And again, like Bill, until you presented me with the terror dream, fear and fantasy in post-9/11 America, the idea that being vulnerable is not a bad thing. It is a way to say, well, yes, look at humanity. It was Mel Konner, the great anthropologist, who said to us in conversation, he was concerned that America has gotten so wrapped up in saying, oh, I'm invulnerable, mm-hmm. that we don't remember the essential animal experience. Of course we're vulnerable.
Right.
Now, what are you going to do about it?
Right.
And the Mary Rowlandson character was just so appropriate to saying, you know, women have an opportunity. Also, Bill says, where are the grown-ups? To be mm-hmm. adults. And
right.
you talk about her providing us with an opportunity to have a whole American womanhood that never evolved.
Right, exactly.
And since you're known for thinking about gender things, mm-hmm. I thought that was pretty central to your story.
Well, and if you look at the days right after 9/11 in New York, for example, you see people, you see another path we could have taken. You see the, you know, individual people on the street reaching out to each other, you know, not reenacting some kabuki drama of masculine dominance and, you know, feminine terror, but people supporting each other, being compassionate, having a sense of solidarity, and being more human.
Gender and ethnicity, race neutral.
Right, but that went away very, very quickly and was replaced by this overarching cultural narrative imposed on us by the media, by the whole, you know, media entertainment nexus. And what happened basically is that we reinstated that American myth of invincibility, invulnerability, this fantasy we have of that we created over many, many years following the Puritan period, to cover up the original foundational traumatic experience we had on the frontier, and to replace it with a fantasy of, you know, 1001 John Waynes and Daniel Boones.
And forgive me if this sounds like I'm tooting the horn, but while I don't spend a lot of time thinking about gender issues, you made very clear that that is central to that revision of which you're speaking.
That's right. The mythology has two parts, and you can't reenact it without both parts. And one is the, you know, the all-powerful, rescuing, triumphal male hero, but he doesn't stand a chance unless he has some helpless woman to rescue. And so women, the formula has a, you know, this national myth has a gender formula at its root. Men, for the nation to be strong, men must be brave and capable protectors, but they can't prove that unless women are weak and in need of a male savior.
This is a variation on this that I found myself thinking about. You're talking about the rescue narratives, and I don't want to go away from that. And the... it's not the same, but it is, I think, of the same character, and that's Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Mm-hmm.
That is, in a way, the you know, the strong woman mm-hmm. version of that. It was extraordinarily popular, probably caused a civil war.
Lincoln certainly thought so.
Lincoln thought so. But I say that, one, because it is in that, within that tradition, but it also brings in some other elements. But the other piece of that, when we talk about the invincibility of this country, of course, that for those of us who grew up in the South, ignores mm-hmm. that 4 or 5 year, actually 15 year period, when the South itself, the inside of the country, was not invincible, and in fact had been vanquished, mm-hmm. Fairly brutally. I'm sure a lot of Southerners would tell you that the first terrorist was, of course, General Sherman.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that.
I don't know that properly phrased that he would deny that. I mean, he set out to destroy mm-hmm. the war-making capacity of the region and did mm-hmm. a very successful job of it. But it seems to me that, again, and I say that not because it goes to our denial of history, mm-hmm. and it also goes to what to me is fundamental to this, is the dangers of denying history. I mean, going to the movies is fine, it's great mm-hmm. entertainment. Building a strategy, a life on bad information, mm-hmm. on bad myths, mm-hmm. is very dangerous. Mm-hmm. And that, as much as anything, seems to be part of the challenge of that you're presenting us with, mm-hmm. is these are bad stories. Mm-hmm. They're not true. If mm-hmm. you make decisions based on these kinds of mm-hmm. Bad stories, bad analogies, you're going to continue to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. And the evidence, I think, you know, to me certainly, is overwhelming that that's what's happened.
Yeah, and I mean, look where we went after 9/11, and we basically were defending a myth instead of defending a nation.
How do you describe where we went after 9/11?
Well, we
off a cliff.
Very steep cliff. We chose to shore up a protection fantasy instead of pursuing practical, methodical methods of pursuing and prosecuting the people who'd attacked us.
And you do say that other parts of the world who are faced with terrorist activities don't do it this way.
Right.
They think of it as criminal, and they don't go culturally nuts and go off and attack people who haven't attacked them.
Exactly. And what this book, at the seat of this book, began when I was in Europe during the terrorist attack on the London subways. And I was reading the British press and listening to BBC, and it struck me that they had a very different response. I mean, they pursued this as a criminal matter that needed to be investigated and the perpetrators brought to justice. And did not see the raft of trend stories that we had in our media about how, well, the attacks are going to cause, you know, women to return to the home, or it's going to cause a marriage boom, a baby boom.
None of
which happened. And then on the male side, that this was going to be the return of the manly man, the return of this brawny, protective masculinity.
And women would go hustling back to the cookie making.
That's right. There was all kinds of very strange stories. I mean, so strange, you think, why did this not strike us at the time? I mean, it didn't strike me till I went back and looked, and story after story, and, you know, in Time, Newsweek, New York Times, et cetera.
Well, and it's misleading because, these are nominally, we take these as purveyors of the truth about the current environment.
Right, we took it as normal.
Yes.
But you look at some of these stories. I mean, Time magazine saying that women were going to stock up on meatloaf pans and were going to sew their own drapes and dresses. Now, as a response to a terrorist attack.
On office buildings and the military establishment.
It boggles the mind. But it makes sense when you see how we the organizing principle behind our national identity.
Well, and when you have the president stepping boldly forward and suggesting that the great sacrifice required is to go to the shopping mall and spend more money.
That's right.
It's not just the media.
But we have a media who didn't respond to that and who actually cheered him on. And when you go back and look at his, the Bush administration's endorsement of torture, well, if you go back and look at the media in the several months after 9/11, you have in mainstream publications like Newsweek, The Washington Post, Atlantic Monthly, leading commentators calling for, we've got to consider torture, proposing secret prisons, proposing extraordinary rendition, all the things that came to pass.
And all of the violations of our civil liberties.
Right.
Well,
I mean, no one said boo. Quite the contrary, when people dissented, and this is something I looked at closely in the book, particularly women and feminists who dissented, they were, to say they were rapped on the knuckles would be to understate it. They were really savaged for it.
Savaged, that would be the word.
Right.
Savaged. We'll come back with Susan Faludi in just a moment, because specifically right there, it seems important that we pursue that idea.
Speaking of savages.
yeah. This is the Paula Gordon Show, Bill Russell, and I hope that you'll join us with Susan Faludi in just a moment. This is the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge, of whom Susan Faludi certainly is one. Bill Russell and I are delighted to be with you, Ms. Faludi.
Thank you. Likewise.
The idea that women's voices were, some women's voices were hushed, were savaged. Mm-hmm. And you give the wonderful, the terrifying example of Barbara Kingsolver, who was quoted over and over again, misquoted, and things she never said. And yet the savagery was very real in attacking what she had not said.
Right.
And at the same time, you have the radical right-wing extremists who were enhancing their fundamentalist perspective that women should be seen and not heard.
Except for right-wing women.
Right.
I mean, when you go back and look, there was a dramatic decline in women's voices after 9/11 on op-ed pages, on talk shows.
And you went through and did the numbers on this.
Right. And a number of other activist or media monitoring organizations did the numbers as well. For example, the White House Project, which is a women's rights advocacy group. And it just so happened they were monitoring on the Sunday morning, those important Sunday morning policy talk shows. And after 9/11, they noticed that the percentage of women guests dropped by 40% to a total of less than 10%.
And the two women who could have genuinely informed us were kept out of that conversation.
Right. The excuse given the producers was, well, this is, we're in a time of war, and, you know, apparently women are not involved. But here, Senators Feinstein and Boxer, just to give one example, who were both at the time heads of congressional subcommittees dealing with terrorism, were nowhere to be seen on these shows.
That's nuts.
Well, and it wasn't just the talk shows. It was all over the place. However, you did, the one place where you did see a lot of women were conservative to right-wing women who were towing the party line, and they were happily invited on. But as you point out, those who had a different point of view, for like Barbara Kingsolver, were just hounded in a way that you wouldn't think imaginable in a democratic press.
You wouldn't
press.
Do a woman, much less within the democracy, right, of which we have claimed.
With Barbara Kingsolver, her first piece simply said things like, maybe we could gain a few, hard-won truths out of this ordeal, and perhaps a capacity for mercy would be a good thing. And for this, she was called, an idiot, a traitor.
This in a Christian nation,
which was nominally
Christian nation.
Yeah, turning the other cheek was not on the table at this point.
But the whole, it's not just turning the other cheek, it's everything that Jesus, I found myself somewhere in this thing of Bob Funk. Robert Funk, who started the Jesus Seminar, late Robert Funk, started the Jesus Seminar to find out what Jesus really said as opposed to what was put in his mouth. And he said, on the basis of his research and in response to it, he had concluded that a lot of people, and perhaps even the majority, if it came down to Jesus or Christianity, Jesus would have to go. That the historical Jesus, the Jesus of the Beatitudes, of forgiveness, basically love your neighbor, love God. But the first one, in some ways, was, and the hard one was love your neighbor, that went away. And I had a lot of the same sense that you have all this empty rhetoric going on that violates, we talked about the terrorists attacking the American values. Mm-hmm. So what do? We have the media and the administration and most, the chattering classes and certainly a majority of the politicians, either out of cowardice or out of misguided belief, undermining American values. Mm-hmm. I mean, pretty much uniformly.
That's what you found, wasn't it?
Well, what you find is, on the one hand, individual Americans who may be struggling with what's really going on in their own private and, responsible and even courageous ways. And then you've got the culture as a whole, which lies over us like a cement blanket. That silences those individual gropings toward truth and reality. It really struck me the other day. I was at the New York Historical Society, which has just opened an exhibit on 9/11, and they have all these photographs and testimonials from people in New York in the early days. And when you look at these, and these are just average, you know, New Yorkers, you look at these photographs, and over again, you see signs being held up, you know, let this not lead us into war. There was one with the John Wayne figure, and somebody, you know, had put a sign over it, you know, this is not the direction we want to go in. And you see the same thing in the taped testimonials.
That was quite touching as you rendered it.
And yet, where did it go? I mean, because we live in a, you know, we're choked by this commercial culture that drowns out the individual human voices and drowns out, or has really wiped out an actual civic and culture, an actual public society. I mean, it used to be the culture came out of the society. Now we have a culture that is imposed on people, and very little civic society to push back.
Go ahead, Mo.
The first heroes, second heroes out of this were of course, the New York City firemen.
Mm-hmm. The real ones, not the ones that pretend.
Right.
And the misrepresentation is startling, but I found myself in near the end to go back to them and their rewards for being heroes.
Mm-hmm. And quote-unquote rewards.
Well, for being heroes. Well, in a way, though, it is standard kit for what we call heroes. You know, the heroes we sent, nominal heroes we send over to Iraq, will we provide them the basics they need? Body armor, armor for their vehicles. Will we take care of them when they come back? Mm. The VA fiasco, the hospital, is screamingly predictable because we've been doing this since the Civil War. We promised black people liberation if they would fight against the British in the Civil War. Mm-hmm. What did we do? As soon as the war was over, back, you know, effectively back into slavery. Mm-hmm. This is a consistent theme. We make people heroes, and that effectively what we say is that's your reward because you ain't going to get anything else. And in fact, we're probably going to treat you fairly badly. And that is what's happened to the New York City firemen.
Right. Well, I mean, the New York City firefighters were asked to settle for hero worship in place of the tools and protections they needed to do their jobs
which effectively killed those people.
And as we all know, Rudy Giuliani has been trying for months now to ride this hero worship of the firefighters to the White House, and the firefighters union in New York is having none of it, saying
they shouldn't have died. If you'd taken care of us beforehand with radios.
That's right.
And we knew that from 1993.
Right, from the 1993 bombing, and even before, they knew that these radios did not work in high rises. The city leadership was supposed to replace them.
That would be Rudy Giuliani.
That would be Rudy Giuliani.
Among others.
I mean, he's not the only one. But there was a no-bid contract made with Motorola that drove to get new radios that drove the price from $1.4 million to $14 million. They got these radios finally. They didn't work. They had to send them back. So they went back to the old radios, and it was the old radios that not only could they not hear the May Day order to get out of the towers before they collapsed, they also couldn't communicate with the police department. And the police helicopter overhead warned the police 20 minutes before the second tower fell, and yet the firefighters in the second tower heard nothing of it.
343 people who did not need to die.
Exactly. And, you know, the media and the political culture spoke for these firefighters, but if you actually go and look at and read what the firefighters said, and there are more than 500 oral history accounts that the firefighters gave the New York Fire Department, in which over and over again they talk about how, you know, victimized, how betrayed they felt by the failure of leadership, by the failure of, you know, basic equipment. And they don't define themselves as heroes in this. They define themselves as victims. You see this quote over and over again. One of the more poignant quotes was, "The only difference between us and the victims on 9/11 was that we had flashlights." Mm. And tellingly, these oral history accounts were repressed for more than 3 years by the city. It went to the highest court in the state before the city was forced to cough up these accounts. And even then, it was, you know, a one-day story.
And then when time comes to give them a raise, they have no.
It was years before they got the raise that they had been promised. Only recently did they get decent, you know, somewhat working radios.
And then you talk about the Jersey Girls, the other half of that part of the story.
Well, the ongoing litany. There are two books here. One is just the representation of the ongoing misrepresentation of fact that seems, you know, that is systematic and predictable. Part of the reason I didn't just tell Paul to turn off the television because I didn't think we'd know anything. You could see what was going to happen, given the behavior of the media to that point. That this was, you could see them just whining, oh boy, we can take off our jackets and smoke cigarettes and talk all night on the air and be the noble souls that we think we are, and that it was going to spin out of control from within 15 minutes of when the event happened. And the other, of course, was that it was clear that there were a lot of political forces that were going to use this, exploit this as an opportunity to drive forward agenda that had nothing to do, and in fact were antithetical to the facts of what were going on and to the facts of what were being threatened.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Bill, before I interrupt.
And I would like Ms. Faludi to address that.
We're going to be back in just a moment. It is The Terror Dream, which Bill says, rightly, is in fact two books. We'll talk about both of those books, all wrapped up beautifully, lyrically, in The Terror Dream by Susan Faludi. Be with us when we return. Welcome back. Bill Russell was asking of Susan Faludi about the two halves of her book. You articulated the first and then told me in the break, the second being misogyny and myth, that being the other half of The Terror Dream.
Which I think, my guess is you have been savaged. I know what the New York Times, which I don't hold in particularly high regard, had to say about this book. But I would assume that there are a lot of people have gone after you, particularly, really for both of them, but in many ways, I think they probably attacked the facts in order to get at the myth and the misogyny.
Well, you would think, but actually, you know, there's been a lot of positive reviews, and
that's good.
As well, there should be.
Including in the New York Times book review. It was just the Daily that was unfortunate, but you know where you see the attacks. It's always for a book I hadn't written.
Mm-hmm. But that's consistent.
Yeah, and it's consistently. It's always about. It's evaluating the book as if I had said that this was a book about what 9/11 did to women and how it set women back, which suggests that the reviewer did not get past page 13, where I say very clearly, this is not a book about what 9/11 did to women or men. This is a book about what 9/11 revealed about our cultural reflex, the mythology that we grasp every time we're in a time of crisis like this. So this isn't about something new. It's about something very old, very deeply ingrained in our culture,
and very dangerous, which is what makes this important.
Because look where we went. We went to, instead of honing a working military strategy, instead of making an actual effort to improve national security, we were fed adolescent fantasies about Amber Alerts and missions accomplished and evildoers crushed. It led to the erosion of our civil liberties. It led to government endorsements of torture. It led us into a war against a people who had not attacked us.
Well, and effectively, not only a government endorsement of of torture, but a public endorsement.
Right.
But no other than our silence.
There's been a very long, deeply disturbing silence, and you see signs of people. Certainly in the polls, and the public attitudes have dramatically shifted into opposition to the war, to dismay, to disgust with the Bush administration's performance. But you don't see a direct societal widespread challenge. You don't see that critical mass out yet raising hell. Well,
and it's also important that you still have to ask the question, can we talk about 9/11 yet?
Right. And there are a lot of people who are not, you know, this is a sacred cow, and we need to plaster it over with platitudes and you know, mantras that are meaningless about the end of irony or 9/11 changed everything, rather than have an honest discussion about this deeply traumatic, deeply important event in our history.
And the good news here is we do have that opportunity. So if we were to take that opportunity, what could we do with this?
Well, again, I go back to we first need to be willing to diagnose the myth before we can even change it. And, you know, I can see just in my experience with the some of the analyses of the book, as you were talking about, that there's hear no evil, see no evil. We don't want to explore this. We don't want to even begin to interrogate our cherished fantasies. We want to, you know, crawl back into the cocoon of our frontier mythology. And so we need to be willing as a people to begin to distinguish between reality and fantasy, to be willing to live in vulnerability, to accept that that is part of being human, and to drop our cartoon, you know, cowboy swagger.
I've got to ask the magic wand question. You've been studying this, you've been writing about it, you've been thinking about it. Not only did the administration let us down, our media has let us down, as you document, and the opposition, nominal opposition, has let us down. Mm-hmm. You go on at some length about John Kerry and his Hunter Act, mm-hmm. in the last presidential election.
2004.
If you had your magic wand, can you see a way to begin to generate that conversation? It doesn't seem to want to come from the top down. Mm-hmm. Bottom up is extraordinarily difficult, but I'm, give me hope. give me the source
That's
and the direction.
That's a tall order. I don't have a formula for constituting effective action, but I think it begins with fighting the passivity that we have just fallen into as a society, that we are consumers more than citizens.
We're spectators also,
exactly.
Which is another part of that.
And 9/11 served that as well. You
right.
can sit back and watch it over and over
again
and not do anything. And those people
which
wanted
was,
to do something. You talk eloquently about them.
The people who wanted to rush to volunteer and, well, you know, 9/11 was sort of, I mean, because it was such a catastrophic event, it just showcased our feelings of passivity, because what could you do? I mean, if the 95% of the people who died were unreachable. They were in the Twin Towers. They were above the fire line. If you were below the fire line, you walked out on your own 2 feet. So there wasn't, you know, there was this great desire to rescue, to help, to be of service. But there was no way of acting on that. And certainly that held true for everybody on the planes. And in a funny way, it's a metaphor for how we are as a consumer culture, where we sit back and watch. We're fed various ways of being sedated, but no way of acting. And I think what is needed is to get back to anger and agency.
Agency being that I can do something. I had a remarkable experience with Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, who, among other things, yes, she wrote The Hidden Life of Dogs, but more importantly, she is a practicing anthropologist, having lived among the people of the Kalahari, the Bush people, the first white family there. And we were in conversation about one of her extraordinary novels set in the Neolithic time, and I said to her quite offhandedly that she had made clear to me that humans' tools included not only rocks and stuff, but shame. And she just stopped and she said, shame as a tool. Yes. And you reinforced that sense with me. And it's in some ways speaks to Bill's question. Talk about the shame part of this and how one can get beyond that to what you call agency.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is why it was so important to understand the early foundations of our history, where and to understand that out of that, you know, those repeated attacks and failed rescues came this deep well of shame that we papered over with this trumped up domestic drama of, you know, rescuing male heroes and you know, endangered and grateful and weak women. So part of the answer is dealing with shame in an honest way, instead of simply trying to, cover it over every time it rears its ugly head.
Go ahead, Bill.
The great American novel, Mark Twain, Huckleberry Finn, the great American source of the American myth is The Searchers, and you do what to me is a wonderful service in going through and documenting how many ways it's wrong, but in many ways it is diametrically wrong. Every lesson that is taken from what was nominally based on a true event, mm-hmm. is within between 160 and 190 degrees wrong, out of mm-hmm. phase with the reality of what happened. And again, it seems to me that part of the challenge is to tell the truth and to examine honestly the myths and their origins and their absolute disconnect. Mm-hmm. These ersatz myths, mm-hmm. in some ways, their absolute disconnect from reality,
including The Searchers. Yeah, precisely. The Searchers is a classic example. The story which inspired the novel of The Searchers, which in turn inspired the movie, is a story of the real life story of Cynthia Ann Parker, a young woman who was taken captive in the 1830s by Comanches from her family's Texas compound. There were a series of bungles and ineptitude that allowed this Indian raid to take place. Other Indians had actually come to the compound and warned the family and gave them the exact date and time. Which will ring a bell for those who remember August 2001 and the communique sent to Bush in Crawford, Texas, of, Osama bin Laden determined to strike in the U.S. Nonetheless, on that exact day and time, most of the men went out to the fields. Cynthia Ann Parker's father was supposed to be guarding the compound. He forgot to load his gun. He didn't lock the door of the compound. So she and others were taken captive. She wound up she spent 25 years living with the Comanches. Married one of the leading warriors and had three children, one of whom, Quanah Parker, became the last leader of the Comanches. And she did not want to come back. And her rescue was forced. Over and over again, they tried to get her to come back. She wouldn't. And ultimately, in a bloody scene that recalls the My Lai Massacre, the Texas Rangers seized her, killed all of it was a group of women and children, but took her because they saw her blue eyes, forced her to go back to her family, which she did not want to do. And ultimately, she wasted away, stopped eating, and died of a combination of starvation and illness. And this is the story that inspired John Wayne saving Natalie Wood, who is eternally grateful.
And the other part of that, of course, is the John Wayne character, the real person, is about as unappealing, dishonest, a thief, well, relatively wealthy, but largely probably misbegotten. But just
and to be fair to John Ford, I mean, the Searchers is a very complex movie, and you can see aspects of I mean, every time I see it, I see something different. You can see aspects of the Wayne character, Ethan Edwards, being a stone cold killer, not being valorized. But in our cultural imagination, that's the average person who thinks of John Wayne and thinks of those Westerns thinks of him as a hero.
Subtlety goes away.
The best thing you can say is a bounty hunter. I mean, that's the most generous description of the actual incarnation of this so-called hero.
Right. The actual figure who became the John Wayne character was, he was actually suspected of murder, among other things. It was hardly a laudable character.
Not a role model.
No.
Susan Faludi will be back with us for a couple of minutes when we return. In a moment, be with us. Susan Faludi, a couple more minutes. I really want to learn from 9/11. I want my country to have cherished that moment and grown up a little bit because of it. How do we, you say it is dangerous to live in a dream. How do we wake up to this and move on?
Well, we could start by heeding some of the people who did wake up and demanded competent leadership, demanded a reckoning, demanded an accounting. Look, for example, at the Jersey Girls. It was a group of women whose husbands had died in the World Trade Center. After 9/11, there was all, along with the firefighters being the heroes, the victims, quote unquote, presented in the media were over and over the 9/11 widows, particularly if they behaved like helpless homemakers and went on, Larry King Live and other shows and said that, no, of course the government's doing everything and I trust the government.
But not the widowers.
Right. Yes. No. It was the widowers were not presented as there were very few articles that even or in very few talk shows that featured them because the victim must be this particular kind of frail woman. But the minute that the widows began to challenge the party line. They were denounced. The Jersey Girls demanded that the government explain the decisions and missteps that led up to 9/11. They almost single-handedly forced the creation of the 9/11 Commission. They should have been honored for their patriotic service. Instead, government officials told them basically to shut up and quote-unquote trust the government. And the conservative media went wild, calling them, hysterics, quote-unquote rock stars of grief. They were swift-boated, accused falsely of taking money from the Teresa Hines Foundation, and were told to keep their mouths closed.
So we shouldn't keep our mouths closed?
Well, as Kristen Breitweiser, one of the... Jersey Girls said in her book several years after this, and she ended it on a very mournful, melancholy note. She said, I feel like Americans just refuse to confront the truth. And that's where we must start. We have to begin to deal with the real world, even when we don't like even when it does not fit our mythic notions of how we should be as a people.
And with that, we thank Susan Faludi, and we thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Susan Faludi has done us all a great service with The Terror Dream. The vital ideas she gracefully articulates hold great promise for a renewal sorely needed in America. She's earned our sincere appreciation, and we thank her. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.